Welcome to the 2018 6th Annual Kessler Neurotrauma Conference, sponsored by Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation and Kessler Foundation. This conference presents an in-depth look at the art of delivering individualized rehabilitation services to this diverse patient population. Physicians, clinicians, and research scientists will provide insight into a range of topics, from mobility and fatigue to intimacy and sexuality to employment and empowerment, and will offer innovative, evidence-based strategies to effectively support both the patient and the caregiver. This podcast was recorded and produced by Joan Banks Smith, creative producer for Kessler Foundation, on Friday, December 7th, 2018, at the Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation Conference Center, West Orange, New Jersey. In this lecture podcast, Dr. Ekaterina Dobokova of Kessler Foundation presents New Developments in Treating Fatigue Following TBI. Dr. Dobokova is a senior research scientist for neuropsychology and neuroscience at Kessler Foundation. For more information about Dr. Dobokova, click on her bio link within the description of this podcast. To listen to more conference podcasts, information about Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation or Kessler Foundation, check out the links within the description of this podcast. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, listen to us on SoundCloud, and tweet with us on Twitter.
Our speaker for 2:30 is Ekaterina Dobokova. So Dr. Dobokova is a research scientist at the Kessler Foundation. Her topic is New Developments in Treating Fatigue Following TBI.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So today I will talk to you about some of my research. And my research includes work using functional magnetic resonance imaging. So it is quite basic, but I'm going to try and relate it to practice and rehabilitation in large strokes, basically. Okay, so we will talk about new developments in treating fatigue following traumatic brain injury. So let me just start by explaining what is meant by fatigue. And when I'm talking about fatigue, I'm mostly talking about cognitive fatigue. And in their seminal paper, Chaudhuri and Bihan, back in 2000, defined fatigue as difficulty in initiating and sustaining voluntary mental tasks. So fatigue occurs in a lot of clinical populations. Individuals with multiple sclerosis experience fatigue, as well as individuals who go through cancer treatment. And also there is chronic fatigue syndrome, which is basically defined by persistent fatigue that does not go away. And also individuals who have stroke and Parkinson's disease also experience fatigue. In terms of traumatic brain injury, up to 75% of individuals with traumatic brain injury report experiencing fatigue. So the common symptoms of fatigue and consequences, of course, include exhaustion and overall lack of energy. And also, individuals who have fatigue say that it is not sleep does not really help them. So when you and I are fatigued, we go to sleep and we usually wake up rested. However, people who have fatigue persistently and a neurological diagnosis, including individuals with traumatic brain injury, say that sleep does not really help them. So, of course, fatigue negatively affects quality of life. It has also been shown to negatively affect rehabilitation gains, and it has been shown to be associated with disability. So here's how patients describe fatigue, and this is a slide that I adapted from Marcia Finlayson, who is an occupational therapist in Queen's University of Canada. People say the following: I feel like my world is shrinking. I have only so much energy during the day. The enjoyable things things go to the bottom of the list. After the chores, I don't have any more energy. It's discouraging. It's debilitating, frustrating, and scary. It's a constant heaviness, like walking in cement. It is constant tiredness. I wake up tired. I go to bed tired. I'm tired all the time. So fatigue being so common, of course, the next question is, how do we measure it? And fatigue is mostly measured by self-report. So there are a lot of measures, and most of the measures are questionnaires. And even these questionnaires can be subdivided onto categories. So there are measures that measure trait fatigue. And these are basically paper and pencil questionnaires, one of the most common ones used in research and that we use at Kessler Foundation very often in fatigue research is the fatigue severity scale. So that's basically a questionnaire where that asks participants to rate certain statements on a scale from 1 to 7, and people have to think back how, for example, their motivation or physical activities were impacted by fatigue during the last week. Also, there is a modified fatigue impact scale. So this is a measure that asks people to think back to the past 4 weeks, so way back. That questionnaire has subscales that asks people to identify statements about how fatigue impacted cognitive activities, how fatigue impacted physical activities, and then there is also a subscale that evaluates psychosocial domains. And also there is a state fatigue measure. So basically, the visual analog scale of fatigue is simply a rating scale that can vary from, let's say, from 1 to 7, 0 to 10, or even 0 to 100. But what's interesting about and differentiates it from the other fatigue measures, the trait fatigue measures, is that the visual analog scale usually asks how a person or the degree to which a person is fatigued in the current moment. Okay, so we know how we measure it. How do we treat fatigue? So far, researchers can't agree on an effective behavioral treatment, but medical doctors do prescribe medication off-label to treat fatigue. And these medications fall in the category of dopamine agonists. So these types of medication, they increase the amount of the neurotransmitter dopamine in the brain. And there are quite a lot of research studies, clinical trials, and some of them are double-blind randomized clinical trials that showed these types of medication, the dopamine agonists, being effective in treating fatigue in cancer patients, in patients with chronic fatigue syndrome, Parkinson's disease, and traumatic brain injury. So, okay, we know that these types of medications have been shown to help individuals with traumatic brain injury. So does this mean that there is an imbalance of dopamine after traumatic brain injury? Bales and others recently showed that indeed there might be an imbalance after TBI. Specifically, during the acute stage of traumatic brain injury, there is some evidence suggesting that there is increased dopamine tone in the brain. So there is more dopamine in the brain after during the acute stage of the TBI. However, during the chronic stage of traumatic brain injury, there seems to be reduced levels of dopamine in the brain. Okay, so dopamine and neurotransmitter, we also know how it is synthesized and the brain pathway that this neurotransmitter goes through. So basically the neurotransmitter dopamine is synthesized in the ventral tegmental area that you can see here at the bottom of in the brainstem. It is also synthesized in the substantia nigra pars compacta, another subcortical region. And then it projects to the striatum or nucleus accumbens, which is basically a ventral striatum. And after that, it goes to cortical areas. And as indicated on the slide, this is often called a dopamine pathway or a reward pathway. So we know that the medication, the dopamine agonists, influences this pathway. But the question is whether we can actually try and influence this pathway without the medication. Because of course medication has side effects, and there can be also issues with adherence. Okay, so also on a global level, and there's some neuroimaging evidence suggesting that this dopamine or reward pathway is actually impaired in a variety of clinical populations, in the individuals who experience fatigue. So our brain is an interconnected entity. So this graph basically shows that the striatum labeled as SN here, it's connected with various areas of the prefrontal cortex, but the dopamine and reward pathway is particularly centered on the ventromedial prefrontal cortex and the nucleus accumbens, which is the ventral portion of the striatum. So as the title of the pathway alludes to, it is involved in processing rewarding outcomes, but also it's involved in learning and outcome anticipation. So for example, we learn through experience that reckless driving is likely to result in getting a ticket. And we also know that we need to perform an action of coming on time to a doctor's appointment in order to be seen by a doctor and then get our results. So this pairing of action-outcome association is basically processed in this pathway. Also, the reward pathway is involved in outcome anticipation, and the best example is gambling. That's the most salient example. So if you go to Atlantic City and you play a roulette, you bet on red, and you have this anticipatory feeling, you're waiting for the outcome, and then if you win, you have an exciting feeling of winning money. So again, all these processes are dependent on dopamine. And basically, these mechanisms were discovered originally in animal research. Research with monkeys determined that dopamine neurons are sensitive to the presentation of rewards and punishments. So in a typical setting, a monkey has to learn to associate a specific button press with an outcome. And usually it's a food outcome. Let's say in this case it's a banana. So when a monkey presses a left button and receives a banana, we see an increase of dopamine neurons. Here, and there is increase of neuronal firing and release of dopamine. However, when a monkey is expecting an outcome, but this outcome is not presented to the animal, so no reward, no banana, then the dopamine neurons don't fire and there is no release of dopamine. So human neuroimaging findings support that this is the basically that this is the mechanism. There is a lot of research using functional MRI, indicating that the reward pathway is sensitive to the presentation of rewards and punishments. Studies that use positron emission tomography indicate that indeed there is dopamine release in humans during reward presentation. And also studies that combine pharmacology and functional neuroimaging show that medications, the dopamine agonist medications that reduce fatigue, also increase reward-seeking behavior and enhance the activation of the reward pathway. Okay, so to summarize what we know so far, we know that up to 75% of individuals with TBI experience fatigue. And also we know that there is a dopamine imbalance such that during the acute stages of TBI, there is an increase in dopamine tone, but during the chronic stage of TBI, there are reduced levels of dopamine. And we also know that reward presentation leads to a dopamine increase in the brain and activates the reward pathway. So the question that I wanted to answer in my research is whether we can reduce fatigue through the use of rewards in individuals with traumatic brain injury who report fatigue. So to answer this question, we recruited 21 individuals with traumatic brain injury and 24 healthy individuals. There were no differences in age, education, or gender. And our participants with traumatic brain injury were, on average, at least 10 years post-injury. And the severity differed. We had one person with mild traumatic brain injury, 9 with moderate, and 11 persons with severe TBI. So during the experiment, participants performed a card guessing task. This is a task that has been validated in healthy individuals and in pediatric populations. And basically, it stimulates goal achievement. So the goal during the task, think back to the roulette example, is the goal is basically to win a monetary bonus. So at the beginning of the experiment, participants were told that they are endowed with money. Basically, they were given $50, and they were told that they can win a bonus during the experiment. So participants were presented with two conditions, so the reward condition during which they were able to gamble and had to try and win a bonus, and then during the control condition, they were not presented with this opportunity. And I will talk more about what participants were presented with at each stage of the task. More importantly, what we did was we also administered a visual analog scale of fatigue, the one that measures fatigue in the current moment, because we wanted to know whether trying to achieve a goal of winning money, in this case, will reduce participants' fatigue versus the scenario where they don't have a goal. And of course, at the end of the experiment, we explained and debriefed everyone saying that the bonus was actually fixed due to ethical requirements of the study. Okay, so here's what participants were presented with during the reward condition of the card task. First, participants saw a question mark, and that indicated to them that they had to guess whether a number on the card is higher or lower than 5. So if participants guessed correctly, they were presented with a green check mark indicating that they just won a dollar. And if they saw an X mark, that indicated to them that they just lost 50 cents. So participants during the reward condition were simply presented with a number, and they had to indicate whether the number was higher or lower than 5, and then they were shown a feedback screen. So this condition served two purposes. So first, we wanted to control for the motor response between the two conditions. So both conditions required a button press. And that way, if we see greater activation, for example, during the reward condition, we know that this activation is due to processing rewarding outcome and not the motor response. And also, we wanted to equate the visual stimuli. So in both conditions, we have first a cue being presented and then a feedback screen being presented. So the only difference between the conditions is this anticipatory and goal attainment component. Okay, and so after each condition, we also presented participants with a visual analog scale where they had to say how mentally fatigued they are in the current moment. So basically, they were presented with a scale that ranged from 0 to 10, and the cursor was centered in the middle, and they had to move the cursor closer to 0 if their levels of fatigue were low, and they had to move the cursor closer to number 10 if their levels of fatigue were high. Of course, we administered trait fatigue questionnaires, the fatigue severity scale that was actually used to screen TBI participants into the study, and the modified fatigue impact scale. We also administered a scale that's called BIS-BAS. So BIS stands for the Behavioral Inhibition Scale, and BAS stands for the Behavioral Activation Scale. BIS evaluates to what degree a participant, or a person rather, wants to move away from goals, so the aversive behavior, and to a degree a person doesn't want to see punishing outcomes. And BAS, the behavioral activation scale, looks and evaluates to what degree someone wants to move towards goals. So basically the degree, how driven a person is and how the person wants to seek rewards. And also, there was a post-task questionnaire where we asked participants about their feelings, the experience during seeing a reward and winning money, and how they felt when they lost money. Okay, so now I will show you some results. On the questionnaires, on the post-task questionnaire, most of our participants said that correctly guessing a card was rewarding and pleasant, while incorrectly guessing the card was upsetting to them. So basically, our manipulation worked. And also, we observed a negative association between trait fatigue and motivational tendencies. So participants who scored high on the fatigue severity scale and the modified fatigue impact scale also scored lower on the BAS subscale. So if fatigue is high, a person is not goal-driven or is not really reward-seeking. And in terms of the fatigue questionnaires, of course, individuals with TBI reported greater fatigue compared to our healthy control participants. So what about the on-task fatigue results? So that's the visual analog scale. So here, what we observed was that reward reduced fatigue in individuals with TBI. So specifically, we observed a group by condition interaction, such as that there was a fatigue reduction after the reward condition in individuals with traumatic brain injury. So if you focus on the green bar, you can see that it is significantly lower compared to the red bar. We observed also between group differences after the no reward condition. So individuals with traumatic brain injury reported higher levels of fatigue after the no reward condition compared to healthy controls. And healthy controls in general reported low levels of fatigue regardless of the condition. What is interesting is that there were also no group differences in reward in fatigue, after the reward condition. So traumatic brain injury participants reported low levels of fatigue after the reward condition, and they were close to levels of fatigue of healthy control participants. Okay, so in terms of the fMRI results, we specifically looked at the reward pathway activation, comparing activation in TBI participants and healthy control participants. And we looked at the activation during outcome presentation of the reward and the no reward condition. So when participants were presented with a feedback screen where they during the time period where they found out whether they won a dollar or lost 50 cents, and that was compared to just the feedback screen of the no reward condition. So here we observed greater activation of the reward pathway after the reward condition, during the reward condition versus the no reward condition in both groups, so both in healthy control and traumatic brain injury participants. Okay, so to summarize, we observed reward pathway activation in individuals with traumatic brain injury and healthy control participants, but only in individuals with traumatic brain injury. This was associated with reduced levels of fatigue during the reward condition. And these findings are actually replicated because we show similar findings in individuals with multiple sclerosis who also report high levels of fatigue. So again, we observed activation of the striatum and regions of the reward pathway. And in our MS and healthy control sample, both groups reported lower levels of fatigue after the reward condition. So these findings might suggest the potential non-pharmacological manipulation of the reward pathway to reduce fatigue. So it seems that engaging in a motivating task can lead to fatigue reduction regardless of the clinical population. So of course, the obvious limitations of the study is that it's ecological validity can be a bit better. Unfortunately, monetary rewards is not something that we often experience during our daily life. We only wish there was winning a lottery every day, but and of course, monetary rewards is not something we encounter during rehabilitation. So how is this relevant to rehabilitation? And what these findings might mean for rehabilitation? Well, there are different types of rewards. There are extrinsic rewards and there are intrinsic rewards. And the extrinsic rewards, I already touched upon them. It's food rewards, usually used in animal research and also in human basic research. Of course, there are monetary rewards, and those rewards are very objective and they can be measured. So we know that a $1 reward is less than $5. So money and food are very salient motivators for most people. However, there are also intrinsic rewards. And those rewards include praise and performance-related feedback. These types of rewards are more subjective compared to extrinsic rewards. So someone might take praise really to heart, while other people might not care as much about it. So it's more tricky. But these types of rewards are more common during rehabilitation and daily life. The important thing is that they engage, these types of rewards engage the same brain region, so the same neural network. As I mentioned, these are the rewards that we usually encounter and give during rehabilitation. So during motor rehabilitation, feedback and instructions are required before an action becomes automatic. Feedback performance-related feedback is basically an important component of cognitive training. So in terms of implications, it's all about outcome value. And how can we deliver feedback or those intrinsic rewards so that an activity is less fatiguing? And this is something that Grant and Ponsford touched upon in their recent paper, saying that we need to try and make rehabilitation as much patient-centered as possible. And when it is patient-centered, patients are able to derive most benefit. And patients' performance improves more on when they are able to reach outcomes that they set for themselves compared to outcomes that are being set by therapists. So an interesting example that emphasizes how it's all about value. In a study by Malhotra and others with stroke patients, they showed that during a cancellation task, patients with stroke were able to cancel or recognize more targets when there was a reward associated with task performance versus on a standard cancellation task. And also what these findings that I just presented to you might mean is that maybe it's okay to give negative feedback, because it's the negative feedback that drives the dopamine response and makes positive feedback more more salient and motivating and also less predictable. And also recently occupational therapy research within the occupational therapy suggests that error-based learning improves self-regulation and skill transfer after training. So also current research that I just presented might provide a theory and neural mechanisms for why goal setting works. In their recent review paper and meta-analysis, Livek and others showed that goal setting is beneficial for self-efficacy and feeling of personal control. And also individuals report better emotional status and health-related quality of life. So going back to fatigue, there is one fatigue self-management program for teleconference delivery. So that is a program that was developed by Marcy Finlayson from the Queen's University in Canada. And it's an adaptation of a program called Managing Fatigue, where individuals had to gather in groups. So this is Marcia Finlayson. She adapted that to be a teleconference delivery program. And basically, it's a six-week group-based intervention that involves weekly 70-minute teleconference calls facilitated by a licensed occupational therapist that's who is trained on the intervention. And this intervention basically teaches fatigue management strategies and utilizes goal setting during final intervention sessions. They showed that this intervention is successful at reducing fatigue and also leads to improved fatigue management and training on setting realistic goals. So this intervention has been administered in multiple sclerosis, but for the future directions in fatigue research here at Kessler Foundation, we want to try and implement the functional magnetic resonance imaging before and after the fatigue self-management program in individuals with traumatic brain injury and multiple sclerosis, and also examine how effort impacts fatigue and how we value outcomes during goal attainment, again, both in traumatic brain injury and multiple sclerosis. Okay, and on that note, I would like to finish the presentation and thank everyone who helped with the research. In your handouts or the presentation that's available online, there is also a bibliography where you can pull the articles that you're specifically interested in. Thank you.
To listen to more conference podcasts, information about Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation or Kessler Foundation, check out the links within the description of this podcast.
Like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, listen to us on SoundCloud, and tweet with us on Twitter.